how close your enemies are. You're hiding in the recess of the cave, and your most mortal enemy comes in to that cave to relieve himself, and there you find yourself. Do you think Saul was by himself? I mean, his army and his people were not that far away. There's one account where they're closing in on him, and word comes to Saul. They're around a mountain, and they're coming from both directions, a pincer movement. I mean, they're about to catch David and his men. And all of a sudden, you know, comes a messenger saying, the Philistines have attacked the land, and so Saul withdrew. God was protecting him. But I think of all of that and what Saul said about him and what he did. I mean, this guy is a mortal enemy. And that's really not what you do with mortal enemies at their death. We didn't sing the praises of Hitler when he died. We didn't sing the praises of Joseph Stalin or anybody else, Mao Zedong. I mean, that just doesn't happen. But it does here. And I think it's very, very instructive to us. Sometimes we say of someone who is grief-stricken that's what they are. They are stricken by their grief. In fact, if you back up earlier in this chapter, in verse 11, when that Amalekite told David the news about Saul and Jonathan and his other brothers were killed and many of Israel were slain, David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. And so there would have been great grief, that idea of being stricken with it. But this formal expression, this singing a song that they would remember, was a means by which someone gets over grief, processes it, works through it, remembers those things that need to be remembered, that are good to be remembered. And that's what I want us to think about this evening as we look at this. First of all, grief and disgrace. Look at 20 and 21 again. Tell it not in Gath. Remember what Gath is. Remember? That's where the giant was from. Goliath of Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Again, that's one of the five cities of the Philistines that were next to Judah. Let the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You mountains of Gilboa, that was the mountain that Jonathan and Saul and his brothers fell on. Let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings or first fruits. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. And probably some remembrance of whether you went into battle or came out of a battle, a shield was anointed with oil. The grief that is here is implicit, I think, not just military shame, not just that all these people have been killed and the king and his sons, the heir and the heirs that would have come to the throne, but obviously God has picked David anyway, but in the normal course of events. If you go back with me to 1 Samuel chapter 28, look with me at verse 15. Then Samuel said to Saul, remember this is when Saul, God is not answering him at all. And so he pays this necromancer to bring him up from the dead. And she herself is surprised, I think, and yells out when Saul, or Samuel rather, comes up. Why have you disturbed me, Samuel says to Saul, by bringing me up? Saul answered, I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me. God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have summoned you to tell me what I shall do. And Samuel said, why then do you ask me? Since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy. The Lord has done to you as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand, given it to your neighbor David, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek. Therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me. The Lord will give the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. We just finished studying 1 Corinthians, or 1 Chronicles this morning. And in the part about Saul, it adds in that book that not only was it because of his sin and not destroying the Amalekites, but because he employed this necromancer to bring up Samuel. It lists two things why God brought judgment and killed Saul. It's a terrible thing that Jonathan was there and had to die too, but we'll get to that in a minute. The Philistines are going to exalt in their gods, are they not? That's what they did. Remember when they took the Ark of the Covenant and they brought it back and they said, our gods are greater, because that's always was the case. If Israel's God didn't protect them, then their gods were greater. And that was never the issue. It was always because Israel sinned that God had forsaken them. You and I know the other side of the story. But the Philistines didn't look at it that way. And that's why he says, let not the daughter of the Philistines exalt. Let not the uncircumcised glory in what has happened. But that's exactly what would happen, because it is religious shame too. And only we would know that by looking at it from the eyes, or through the eyes of God. The second thing is, not all things are as they seem. Remember Dagon? They bring that Ark of the Covenant in 1 Samuel 5 when they destroy it. And remember, that's when Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas all die. There is no king, of course, at that point, but many of Israel were slain. And they set the Ark, it says, by the god Dagon in their temple. Next morning they get up and Dagon's fallen on his face. It says in front of the Ark, as if he's bowing before God. So they set him back up. That's hilarious. They take their great God and set him back up on his pedestal. Next morning they wake up and go in, and this time not only is he down prostrate before the Ark of the Covenant, but his head is severed and so are his hands. And they never, it said, went in, the priest did, ever again into that. I think they got the message. Because then God began, and they feared every time the Ark was brought to different cities of the Philistines. Well, things are not always as they seem, and we need to remember that. We need to understand that God is working and that God is carrying out his will, and what may look like an utter defeat and the enemy has been exalted. It's not always the case. It's that God used the enemy to punish his people. And so the last thing that is said to us in this opening part is that they are to teach this to Judah. And he said, let it be taught, verse 18, to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written, the bow song is written in the book of Jasher. The book we read about at various times, it must have recorded the chronicles of what went on. The military youth were to hear this. They were to sing it. So were Israel, the women, the men, all. They were to remember that Gilboa was not the last time that they would meet the Philistines in battle. Though it was a national disgrace and disobedience was a cause of what had happened, they were to remember that tragedy. There's a reason to learn from it. As the Chronicles would write, one of the reasons that Saul was killed was because he had not followed the will of God. Follow the will of God. Be deeply stirred and moved to that action. And never, never let it happen again. In modern Israel today, the armored corps, when young people, and you know there are countries that you have to serve in the military. Years ago, we had a Norwegian exchange student that we converted to the Lord when I worked in Pasadena with Dee. We converted him to the Lord, and he had to go back to his country, and for 2 years, he had to serve in their military. Not a bad thing, but that's side note. But Israel does that too. These little tiny countries can't depend on a volunteer force that we do in our military in modern times. And so every young person upon reaching age 18 go into the military and serve for, I don't know how long Israel does, but at least usually it's 2 years. They go to the top of the fortress of Masada. Do you know about Masada? Masada was an impregnable fortress. You ever seen the pictures? I meant to put this in the PowerPoint and forgot. Masada was the last major stronghold when the Romans came and began to decimate and destroy Israel when it had rebelled Judea in the New Testament. Remember that they destroy the temple, kill all of these people, sacrifice them, or crucify them rather, as far out in the city sometimes as 2 miles out till they ran out of wood. Imprisoned or in slavery, all the rest. And that revolt, though, lasted from 68 AD to 73 AD. So in 72 AD, the last stronghold that is held had been built by Herod the Great, the formidable fortress of Masada, impregnable. There was no way up it. In fact, the siege mound that is still there, you can still see it. The dirt that was laid up at great cost to the Romans, they paid for it dearly because people could shoot down on them. They had plenty of water above. In the rainy season, there were many cisterns that collected vast quantities of water. So they could have held out for a long time and did. From 72 to 73, 960 Jews held out against Flavius Silva's Roman legion. And after 7 months of siege, the Romans breached the fortress, and you can imagine what vengeance they intended to wreak. But they were denied it. Because during the night, the leader of that movement and the others went and killed everyone that was there and then committed suicide themselves so that no one was left to take vengeance upon. And Masada remains as a symbol of courage to the modern Israeli troops who, upon entering their duty as soldiers in the armored corps, stand at the summit of Masada and swear the oath of allegiance to the modern country of Israel, that Masada, they say, they shout it, shall never fall again. You imagine that's sort of the kind of stirring thing that this lament is intended to create in God's people. So what kind of lessons might we learn from this first point? First of all, we must never let sin remain in the camp. We must never allow the kind of thing that caused this to come about in the first place. Think of Achan in Joshua 7. Even though the people were in many ways innocent of what had happened, God wreaked his vengeance upon the collective. There were men that went up to Ai who were not responsible for what Achan had done, and yet they died. And God wreaked his wrath upon all of them, saying, that until you find it out, and lots were taken, you can imagine, as they came down, and finally Judah's taken, and then finally the household of that Achan belonged to was taken, and it gets nearer and nearer to Achan. God was telling them something. That sin is so awful and it is so dreadful and I hate it so much. That you and I, even though might not be responsible for what has happened in the group that is the collective, God doesn't look at it that way. You and I must always be involved with each other. We must be aware of what's going on. He will not tolerate sin. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. They knew what was going on there. And yet they had done nothing about it. And on that story could go, but we need to remember that God, as he said to Joshua, cannot. Sin is in the camp. Get up. Do something about it. Never let it happen. The other thing, of course, is, and we talked about this Wednesday night, is that we must cease this madness of churches dividing God, the body, as if an eye could walk away from the body, an ear could sever itself and depart, that several members could. That if we thought of ourselves as God wants us to think of ourselves, Ephesians 4, verse 3, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace, if that really rested in our hearts, you're not responsible. The people that left are. And it's always that way. And 9 times out of 10, in preaching the number of years I have preached, it's not about doctrine. It's about people not behaving as God wants them to behave. And we need to make up our mind that we're not going to be a part of that. I've said over and over again, I'm not ever going to be a part of a split. If a congregation decided to do that and said, we want you to remain, half of us, we want you to remain with them to go, I'd say, I ain't doing that. I'm leaving both of you. Because I'm not going to be responsible to stand before God and give answer for his body being severed from each other. Especially if it's about me, that is not going to happen. You know, I'll be adios. You ask me to come, you can ask me to go. There's too many preachers, though, that do not operate by that. And it's because you can see the aftermath. You can see they stayed. They caused a division or allowed a division to go on. And the same is true of elders. And the same is true, you know, just go on down the line of family members that will not receive the discipline of a family member. On and on are the reasons why things happen in this. We must never let that happen. It is a grief It should be a disgrace to us. The other thing that comes out of this, of course, is the grief of love. Verses 22 through 26 is that part that he now sings about Jonathan and about Saul. He begins it, "From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions." Drop down to verse 25. We'll come back to Saul. "How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan, lie slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished." The thing that was so wonderful about Jonathan was his unflagging loyalty, his undying faithfulness to both David and to his father, Saul. What a tragic figure. Not tragic because he was tragic, a sinner. That is, an unrepentant sinner, a messed up person like his father. He was the opposite of that. But he is in literature what is called a tragic figure, in that there was no outcome for him that was going to be a good end. Can you imagine, had he stood with David next to him, there was always that undercurrent of Benjamin, remember, Shammai, others, that cry out later, "You stole the kingdom, you killed Saul." You know, that could always have been, because who should have been king after Saul died? Jonathan. So there's no good outcome if he stands with David or if he goes fully with his father. And yet he was faithful to both. He was a friend of friends to David. Jonathan never swayed. There are times that he grew angry at his father. His father even trying to hurl a spear and kill him as well. In Proverbs 27 and verse 10, the text says, "Do not forsake your friend or your father's friend." In Psalms 15 and verse 4, "He who swears to his own hurt and does not change is one that stands before God." Jonathan was a faithful person. Jonathan was willing to play second fiddle. The last time that he meets David, he says to him in 1 Samuel 23:17, "You will be king, and I will be next to you, and my father knows this, and he will never find you, he'll never get you," because again, Jonathan was a spiritual man, and he knew that God would protect the anointed that he had made David. Always I'm sickened by people that think of the words here of Jonathan that David speaks are homosexual love. The point of the comparison between Jonathan's love for David and a wife's love is not sexual, but fidelity. In fact, as you think of a marriage as it goes forward, there reaches a point in any marriage that the sexual relationship no longer takes place. But there is something that goes far, far deeper than that, of years and years of going through both the hardships and the good things of life, and yet always finding each other in love and devotion and faithfulness. The one final thing that you say about somebody is that they were faithful to each other unto death. It means much more than that we would consider as a sexual side of things. Jonathan's life didn't turn out like he had hoped or dreamed. But we can truly at times understand that from such lives that we consider tragic figures, yet there is this great, great overarching thing in a life like Jonathan. He wanted God's will more than he wanted his comforts, desires, wishes, hopes, dreams. If I must play second fiddle and you must be king, I will stand next to you. And he fully meant that. Here's the one that will shock you. And we began the lesson with that. That he doesn't gloat over Saul's death, that he doesn't talk about all the terrible things Saul did against him. Rather, he remembers the good. And there's not any mention of all the terrible things we know about Saul. He doesn't even mention it in the song. Look at what he says about him when he sings of him. We've already read the part, beloved and lovely in life and in death and swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. Verse 24 is just about Saul. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul. Who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet and put ornaments of gold on your apparel. You ever thought about all that? Turn back with me, if you will, to 1 Samuel 14. And it begins the reign, or actually the summation. There are three summations in 1 Samuel. There's the summation of Samuel. Even though Samuel goes on, there's a summation of him in chapter 7. Because in 8, now you have Saul taking over. Now there's a summation of Saul's life in chapter 14, because in 15, he's rejected by God. Same thing's going to happen with David. There will be a rejection of David when we finally get to what he does in 2 Samuel with Bathsheba. You have the same sort of thing, sort of a summation, even though they go on living. Why is the summation here? Because there's a new chapter, a big chapter that the turns to. But here's what it says about Saul. Verse 47, when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all its enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, against the Philistines. That sound like David? Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. And then at verse 52, there was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. When Saul saw any strong man or valiant man, he attached him to himself. I'll tell you, sometimes we just give Saul a bad picture, but here's what it sums him up as. He fought and delivered Israel again and again and again. He harassed the enemies. Now, he didn't do it as fully as David would, but he did. And in result, he says to the daughters of Israel, he clothed you, here's the spoils of the war, he clothed you luxuriously in scarlet and put ornaments of gold on your apparel. You prospered under the hand of Saul. David remembered that. You know how much bigger man he is than many, many people I've encountered, including myself. He's big to be able to do that. So overall, what are lessons we can draw? First of all, I think of men who we have held in high esteem, especially gospel preachers that sort of have they're known everywhere. And you can think of some of them. And sometime in their life, they may have held a wrong position on something. In fact, it may have been something very significant. I think about Brother Homer Haley. Will and I, when we were training, I was at Southside, and we were just brand new at everything. Brand new at marriage, brand new working as a preacher. And of all things, Dee, in the very opening lectures that they had, he puts Brother Homer Haley with us. Brother Haley's going to spend the week in my house. Okay, so those of you that don't even know who I'm talking about, just think of the greatest kind of person you could think of. You know, almost close to the President of the United States. And he's going to come be with you for a week. We'd heard about Brother Haley's odd eating habits. He had had cancer way, way back in his life, and he had fought against it and defeated it. So he became a very ardent student of eating right. And so he had a brewer's yeast mix that he made every morning. And we heard about this awful concoction of just, you know, adding all kinds of things. And Will and I were nervous, and we didn't know what to do. So we go out and we buy the peanut butter that, you know, the oil separates from it, you know, and you have to mix up so there's none of this sugar or anything that's in it. And the tackets are looking at each other because y'all probably buy that kind of peanut butter. And you know what? We went out and bought, Will had peaches. She had canned, no sugar in them, just straight off the trees. We didn't tell him it had been sprayed with pesticides, but anyway. You know, cheese, we just tried the grapes, and we got the organic stuff. We tried to think of everything we could do, you know, because Brother Haley's going to be in our house. We ended up having the most wonderful week. I had bees in the backyard, you know, so every day he'd finish, He finished lunch with a big old tablespoon of honey. He just put it in there, round it till, you know, and that's what he ate. But Brother Haley, not long after all of that, you know the story, he held a position on marriage, divorce, and remarriage that just simply was wrong. And many, many of brethren knew it. He'd held it for a long time, held it for many years. He never caused division to anyone's knowledge. He never talked about it. If you asked him about it, he would tell you. To anybody's knowledge, he never practiced it. He never had a situation where he prayed, but he held the position nonetheless. Come along, in my estimation, far, far lesser brethren. In fact, brethren I'd have nothing to do with because of their attitude, how they cornered him, and had a secret tape in there to tape him. And now they had it all. And they turned everybody into war. To the point that I come along, and I'm trying out in a congregation, Kleinwood it was, in Houston. And there's a grilling session where I'm in front of the entire congregation. Anybody can ask me anything. There's a guy on the back row, raises his hand. I said, yes, sir. He said, what do you think about Brother Homer Haley from the back row? He was dead, folks. But I had a guy on the back row ask me about him. There's a kind of a devious part of me that wanted to say, well, I think he's about 6 foot under. Does that answer your question? He's before God, and God will decide. But I said, do you want to redirect that question? What are you asking me about, Brother Haley? And so then we talked about the position, because that's what he was really asking. But nonetheless, is there any honor in plunging the sword into God's anointed? Now, I know Brother Haley wasn't God's anointed. Wasn't even close. But here's what David did when that guy came down and he said, here's what happened. He tells that story that we know about, but he says he came along and Saul was still alive. Now, is that true or not true? Did there is an addition to it or not? Probably not. But he wants to get in good with David because that's what worldly kings do. So he said he wasn't dead yet and he didn't want the Philistines to abuse him, so I killed him. They all grieve and tear their clothes. And then he says, bring that Amalekite to me. He said, you didn't even hold your hand back to strike the Lord's anointed. And he looked at one of his young men and said, kill him. And he killed him. And he said, that's what happens to anybody that raises their hands against the Lord's anointed. There's no honor in striking at somebody after they're dead. Is there any honor in that? They're far, far lesser brethren that I've encountered all along life's way that I wouldn't have anything to do with. I'm going to tell you whose shoulders I stand on. I stand on the shoulders of Bob Bolton. I stand on the shoulders of W.L. Horton. I stand on shoulders, not very long from now, of Dee Bowman and Ed Harrell, who has passed, and Paul Earnhardt. And many men who have been vilified because of positions they may have held, right or wrong, brethren writing about them and every kind of stinking thing you can imagine that's said. And I know better than that. I know them. I know them personally. But folks, what you, at the end of the day, realize about anybody, as great as they are, they're made of clay. We say that, don't we? As great as they are, they have feet of clay. As great as you think you are, as great as you think the preachers that you might know, the great you think your father is, you know they have feet of clay. You know they're not perfect. You know they make mistakes. You know they probably have held positions that you wouldn't agree with. But you still loved them and honored them. Because of what they did teach you. The good and the right and the things that mattered. And that's what David does about Saul. He doesn't talk about all the bad stuff that Saul did. And this lament that he talked and the Spirit recorded for the children of Judah to sing is to remember that. Now, having said all of that, the caveat, God is their judge, not us. You must not construe that what I've said to you this evening means that we tolerate sin or false teaching. There were people that no longer could have, and I included, would have ever had Brother Haley come preach where I am after he made himself very public about what he believed. Those days passed, and passed quickly, because you could not dare do such a thing. It wasn't right. We must stand on truth and expose darkness. But we must remember that men good and righteous, as I said to you, are mixtures of both clay and iron. They are never perfect men. And they stand before God. What I will remember about Brother Haley, I will remember about all the other men who are mixtures of clay and iron, is the overall arching goodness and righteousness of what they taught, what they believed, what they preached, and the churches they strengthened and made better in all their lives. It is right and proper for us to weep for the mighty who have fallen in Israel. Remember to balance. I cannot tolerate the wrong, but I will remember the good and sing it. You're subject to heaven's invitation this evening. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you tonight to become a Christian, or if you need to come back and make God known the things you have done, while together we stand and sing.